This is Primal Screen, a weekly radio show airing Monday evenings on Triple R. Primal Screen is about movies, from the ones on the big screen to the ones you stream. Hope you enjoy the podcast version and feel free to get in touch via the Primal Screen Facebook page or the Triple R website.
Welcome to Primal Screen, a show and podcast all about screen culture, from movies on the big screen to whatever you're streaming. We're broadcasting tonight from the Triple R studios on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation. This is and always will be Aboriginal land. I'm your host, Flick Ford, and I'm joined in the studio tonight by Telford Mills. Hey, Telf.
Hey, Flick.
Orange Juice's Tyler Vane on your airwaves every Tuesday morning, Monday night.
Yeah,
4 a.m. till 6 a.m.
That's right.
Hi, Tyler.
Hello, Flick.
And making her Triple R debut, Sarah Richardson. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Flick. Hi, everyone.
So on tonight's show, we're spotlighting the work of British filmmaker Mike Lee. Now, he's often described as one of the great storytellers of everyday British life on the big screen. He was awarded an OBE, an Officer of the Order of the British Empire, in 1993. We're going to have a specific focus on three of his films tonight. Happy-Go-Lucky from 2008 with Sally Hawkins as a bright and breezy primary school teacher getting driving lessons from a wound-up, scowling Eddie Marsden. His 2010 film, Another Year, with Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen as a happily married couple, weathering the ups and downs of their friendship and family over the course of a year. And we're going to finish up the hour with his most recent film, Hard Truths, from 2024, with Marianne Jean-Baptiste as a deeply depressed and anxious woman with a tremendous amount of rage. But before we get into the reviews, I'd love to hear how you describe Mike Lee's style and the kind of stories that he's drawn to. Do you want to kick us off, Sarah?
Sorry, I saw that. I don't want to steal his thunder, but I did see that Telford had the word singular written in all caps in his notebook. And so that was amazing.
It's true.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about Mike Lee is that he does have several different modes, right? He has the domestic, you know, kind of comedic dramas that are really focused on class dynamics, on like familial and, you know, kind of small community dynamics, often, you know, not really plot-focused, very character-focused. You know, there's a lot of, they're often kind of actors' showcases. There's these kind of like, you know, everyday life stories told within kind of a small scale, often within living rooms and occasionally a little bit of workplaces, but it's really often focused within the familial home. But at the same time, you know, Lee expands outwards to, he has this historical film, so you have like, you know, the great spectacle of Mr. Turner. You have, I haven't seen the historical drama Peterloo about a massacre and class movements from a few years ago. And you have, yeah, Topsy Turvy, which is like quite a wonderful and decadent, historical period piece about the famous playwright Skilbin Sullivan, the musical theatre, you know, impresarios. I think his style is often very intimate. It's conversational. It's often about, you know, the kind of, yeah, these like these small ways that people pass, you know, build a life together through endless cups of tea and over meals, you know, just very basic daily meals. And, you know, there usually does like build to some kind of crisis, but there's that real attention to just the way that we pass our days and the way that we move together through space. I mean, I'm saying we, but, you know, I guess it's this particular group of like usually working class to middle class British people.
I think something that's really important to talk about with Mike Lee, for people who don't know, is the way he kind of makes his movies.
Mm.
And moving back to our favourite singular, in a very quick summation, he will basically choose the actors he wants to work with and say, do you want to work together, yes or no? They start off with a completely blank canvas, and then over usually a couple of months, they develop the characters together from the ground up. And I mean by things like, which toothpaste do they use? What was their favorite snack when they were five? You know, every detail of their life in almost like ridiculous level. And then after a couple of months, we'll start kind of figuring out who the characters are and stuff. But it's a completely, no one else, as far as I know, makes movies like that. And he's done it in such a way that I think it's getting harder and harder for him to get funding because people, you know, don't want to commit to a movie without a plot. But he's very singular. He doesn't do things, he does things completely his own way and would never kind of humble to fame or put people, famous people in his movies that, you know, there's a great quote of him I read today, which was something like, yeah, Michael Caine's like a great actor, but I'm never putting him in one of my movies, duh. just meaning he's very committed to sort of working with, you know, not movie stars necessarily. And I think that the performances of the female actors in his movies is the best collection of female performances by a director I've ever seen. Mm. I think the performances across, and we'll get into these later, but Sally Hawkins in Happy Go Lucky, Lizzie Manville in Another Year,
Marianne
Jean-Baptiste, sorry, in Hard Truths, Vera Drake, Belinda Bethan in Secrets and Lies. I mean, yeah. I don't know how you top those performances at all, personally. Mm. And there's like, that's just the first ones I've thought of. I think you see the devil in the details and how much that process pays off when you're like, these characters are like, you believe that they're real people from the first scene throughout.
There seems to be a tremendous amount of trust at the core of these working relationships. The fact that he returns to the same actors and he's created this kind of legacy of work with them, like Jim Broadbent, Timothy Spall. You mentioned Leslie Manville already. But
I think she's done the most.
And Sally Hawkins has also done a few. And
Ruth
and
Gordon as well is really consistent. Ruth Jane, sorry. Oh, no. Yeah, Ruth Gordon would be fun in there, actually. But yes, Ruth Jane.
There's been so many actors that he's repeatedly worked with. And also, I think we should make mention to Dick Pope.
All of
the films that we're talking about he's worked with the DOP, Dick Pope. And it's just so interesting what can build up over time with that. Tyler, I was really intrigued by the fact that you also are a Mike Lee fan because I bumped into you at a lovely little film group.
Nowhere Film Club.
Nowhere Film Club was playing Mike Lee's Life is Sweet.
Yes.
How did you first come across Mike Lee's work?
I was thinking about that on the way here, and I wish I had a cooler answer, but the truth is that in 2017, I must have been, I think, 19, freshly moved out of the city, and I went to see Good Time, the Safdie Brothers movie, and as any 19-year-old in 2017, probably, you know, like a burgeoning filmmaker, I got really obsessed with that movie, and in a lot of interviews, the brothers would mention specifically Mean Time by Mike Lee. And Mike Lee was a name that kept coming up when they spoke about, like in their very, very impassioned way about their influences. And so I kind of started with Me Time and then kind of devoured the entire filmography and found that he not only quickly became one of my personal favorite filmmakers, but any new kind of contemporary filmmaker that I attached myself to or that I really started to admire was also a huge Mike Lee fan. His movies are completely evergreen too. I know a lot of like the people who run Nowhere Film Club are even younger than I am, and they're all fresh Mike Lee fans. Like they probably got into him in the last year or two and are just huge fans. And part of the reason why they programmed Life is Sweet is because they were just so excited about sharing that movie in particular, but his entire filmography with other young early 20s filmmakers. Of course, the process that you mentioned, Telford, is something that gets brought up a lot with Mike Lee, rightfully so, because it is singular. It's extraordinarily unique. I tried it once too in my own filmmaking process. It is not easy and it's costly as well. Like you don't just do that and have it work out magically. You have to actually be good at doing that. Sometimes I feel like it's a shame that people can get so caught up on that process and how unique the process is, because ultimately when you're watching one of his movies, none of that is showing. They're not improvising on the day. You're not getting the slightest sense that what you're watching is being improvised. It's more like watching an extremely tight, extremely poured over script. When I paired those two things together, knowing about this really, really unique process and then seeing the films and not really kind of having a bit of incongruity between those two things, the process and the finished product, that really, really hooked me. And I think that pushed me further down my love of Mike Lee.
That's such a beautiful way to capture. I feel like as a viewer, we're in such safe hands, and he's got such a tremendous filmography, and we're obviously not going to be able to cover everything, but I'm sure we'll pull out parts throughout the night and lots of common threads that exist within his work. Stay tuned. You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
Life is tragic and life is comic. My films are tragic comedies, always. People say to me, where do you get your ideas from? Well, the truth is, I've only got to walk down the street. If I pass 10 people, there are 10 possible films there, really.
Triple R.
There's sadness in what's happening from the word go, and, you know, people are crazy and grotesque, yourself and myself included. I'm there to make you care, to move you, to make you laugh, to make you cry, and to, in that sense, hopefully, without being pompous about it, to improve your lives. That's what it's all about. That's what we're in the business of doing. And to entertain. I mean, make no mistake about it. I mean, you know, we are in show business. We are entertainers. Before too long, I will no doubt exit this mortal planet, and I'll feel okay about it, really, you know.
You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R with Sarah Richardson, Tyler Bain, Telford Mills and myself, Flick Ford, and the track you just heard was Pulp with Common People, which features in the first film that we're reviewing tonight and is also very on brand for tonight's show. We are, of course, spotlighting the work of British filmmaker Mike Lee, and we begin with Happy Go Lucky from 2008.
But not everyone in her life...
What is the passions? What is the blood? This is flamenco!
...is as happy-go-lucky.
Come on! Drive the car! You're not driving a camel!
In Happy-Go-Lucky, we are introduced to Poppy, played by Lee regular Sally Hawkins, a bubbly and colourful 30-year-old primary school teacher with seemingly unwavering positivity. When learning to drive, she meets instructor Scott, played by Eddie Marsan, who seethes with resentment and unfulfilled desires. Tyler, what are your thoughts on Happy-Go-Lucky?
This is a perfect movie. You
can't. No notes.
They don't make them any better than this. Happy-Go-Lucky is such a unique movie to try to pitch to someone by, I guess, simply saying to them, this is a movie about a woman who at all costs or against all better judgment is able to find positivity in every single corner of her life. And I think if you heard that, you would probably think, well, that boring. And maybe for some people it is. But I think it's kind of as you were saying before, Telford, not only is Mike Lee able to get these extraordinary performances, particularly from his female leads, but this is my favorite one. Sally Hawkins in Happy-Go-Lucky is one of the most layered and constantly rewarding performances I've ever seen. I rewatched it yesterday. I was just so surprised with the grace and the empathy that Mike Lee affords the Eddie Marsden character, despite him being this extremely difficult man. And I think that, for me, a friend of mine, Lucy, who runs Nowhere Film Club, which we mentioned earlier, describes Mike Lee with that word in particular, in that he's empathetic to difficult people. And I think that kind of summarizes the whole thing for me, is that his characters might be joyous in the face of despair, or they might be closed off to the point of conspiracy, like Eddie Marsden's character, but Mike Lee is always able to be objective about them and find reasons to watch them and to live with them and to sit with them. And I think Happy-Go-Lucky is a beautiful example of the polarities of that. You have a character who is, even as a viewer, difficult to be around. And then you have someone who lights up every single scene that she's in, and both are afforded the same amount of respect. And I think that's the thing that I appreciate most about Happy-Go-Lucky.
This was a film that I remember it coming out, and I was just like, I'm not going to see that. And I
probably because of that kind of trailer.
Yeah, precisely. It really did. And I thought it was going to be a particular kind of film, and it's so far from that. and so much more nuanced, so much more layered than I was anticipating. And I agree, Hawken's performance in it, she's so elastic on screen. Mm. There's so much depth to her, and be so easy to dismiss someone with that kind of level of happiness as they're not seeing the full picture, and which is a great contrast then to Marsden's Scott, who is thinking that he's seeing all the angles and, you know, he's going to teach her a thing or two. And I just loved that tension. Telford, you mentioned before how he presents women on screen, but the female friendships in this film felt so real to me, and it felt such a beautiful portrayal of a woman who is still young but is told that she's running out of time and that she needs to grow up. And I loved the beautiful friendship that she has with her flatmate. I loved that pairing between Hawkins and Zegerman, and apparently they became friends in real life, and the tension between the sisters who we meet later. I just found it all so believable, and that's obviously a signature style of Lee. Sarah, did you see it back when it came out?
Yeah, I did. This was, because my parents, you know, watched a lot of films, and I remember them having the DVD, or not a DVD, it's pre-DVD, VHS of the cassette of Secrets and Lies Around the House. And then so, I watched Happy Go Lucky with my parents, and I was really taken with it in terms of, like, as you said, you know, the way that Poppy's joy and eternal optimism and playfulness is dismissed often as a, you know, as a lack of intelligence, right? And I think the film does a really great and quite elegant job of, like, you know, we get to see these nuances of Poppy. We get to see, like, that she is intelligent, that she is good at her job. You know, she intervenes when this child is lashing out and sees that actually something else is going on. She doesn't respond in a punitive way. She gets to be sexual. She, like, you know, we get to see that she does, like, have judgment and discernment, and, like, when she expresses anger around, you know, lurking creeps in chat rooms and about her relationship with her father. But, the way that, like, people, especially men around her, dismiss her joy in terms of, as her not being serious. So I think that that's one of the wonderful things about the film. And, like, watching it again in the last week, I really appreciated the playfulness, the verbal playfulness that comes through, especially with Poppy. And, like, this is something you see throughout so many of Mike Leigh's films, that, like, the way that people, like, build love within families or within functional relationships is through these just, like, constant little in-jokes and silly, like, not even, they're almost, like, often unfunny, but, like, you know, these, like, silly little things and jokes that people have together. And so many of the little conversations that Poppy has with the people she loves are, like, they're not really saying anything, but it's that verbal playfulness that is just, like, building intimacy and care and attention. And I found that really moving and beautiful. And I do love the way that, even though, like, this, you know, boyfriend character does sort of come in later in the film and does play quite an important, like, you know, plot point, both, you know, builds Poppy's character in terms of, we get to see her being, like, an adult sexual woman. She's not infantilized, but also then obviously it's important plot-wise in terms of the confrontation with Scott, her driving instructor. Even then at the end of the film, it's still, she does get a phone call from Scott, but it's still, like, she's on the lake with Zoe. Like, it's still her relationship with Zoe that's the real, like, arc of the film. It's the spine of the film that we get to see that. Flick, did you feel yourself quite represented? You do bear more than a passing resemblance to Miss Hawkins and some of her admittedly quite 2008 style.
I knew you were gonna say that.
Yeah, and you're a happy-go-lucky gal.
I feel like at my core I'm more of a Larry David.
Okay, yeah.
Not with that hair, you're not.
But you've got a little veneer, you've got an icing of Poppy, perhaps.
Yes. I also bet that's probably what Poppy would say.
Yeah.
There's some humility in that.
Yeah. I do love Sally Hawkins. I feel like she's so well cast in this. But just on that point, Sarah, about the dialogue, there's so much patter.
Yeah.
And I feel like it comes really close to being annoying, and then it just, it's somehow, you're right, it's like the building love between the characters. It's exactly what it's doing. It's like a dance between these two women, especially. Like, I feel like Zoe and Poppy have this wonderful
And her sister as well.
Of course.
They have a beautiful relationship.
We have to give a shout out to Cato Flynn, who folks would have likely seen more recently in Widow's Bay and is exceptional in that TV series. Just back to Poppy, she's also quite feisty, and I feel as though she puts herself in quite dangerous situations and has so much courage and empathy in those spaces. It's really fascinating to watch on screen. Mm.
Yeah, I was reading the Roger Ebert review of this today, and as I have many times, I like his reviews a lot, but he says that this is the story of a good woman. When I first saw it, the first 5-10 minutes, you're like, oh, come on, like, is this it? Like, you're just like a bit of a giddy idiot. And then as the movie goes on, it builds this character of her, and she kind of, it's sort of slowly revealed, like you were saying, right? That she's kind, but she's also like strong and smart and like compassionate. I feel like I just wanted to hang out with her and would.
It's quite cozy without
it's
being
so
saccharine.
It's so cozy.
Yeah.
And I've seen this movie, I don't know, maybe of 6 times now. And I do find not all of Mike Leigh's movies, but some of them, and particularly the ones we're going to talk about today, like endlessly rewatchable. Like I could watch Happy-Go-Lucky every year. And the thing I always think when I'm watching it is every time they finish one of the scenes, like you're like, I could watch another 30 minutes of these guys hanging out.
Yeah.
I could watch another 30 minutes of like her like going to the sisters and like what they're going to do the next day and walking along the beach. And I just want more of it. Like I just want that.
Yeah.
There's something so satisfying about it's, you know, I think people compare him to Ken Loach a lot, and I think the comparison's kind of there, but like you don't rewatch Ken Loach movies in the same way. Like there's a kind of like coziness and a humor to Lee that is just, and it's just very hard to beat. And I just would have watched another hour of it, to be honest.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like this has been the nicest homework I've set for us because it's been so lovely to sit in the work, especially watching them almost back to back, like every night watching a Mike Leigh film. It's a great way to spend your time. You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
I'd worked with Sally Hawkins a few times, then Vera Drake playing the posh girl who is able to get an abortion privately because she's got the resources and means to do so. And also she was, of course, in All or Nothing. And so we'd worked together and I knew her, and I just thought it would be great to make a film where we tap into her energy. She's got a kind of positive energy.
And they told you the price, £22.50 an hour.
Yeah, that's right. Cheapest chips, you know.
We may be cheap, but we're better.
I am?
You want to go with the big companies, they use inexperienced instructors.
They don't.
They've just passed their test and they charge more.
Bastards.
Us experienced instructors, we go with the small companies and we charge less.
That makes a lot of sense, that does.
There were people that said, I couldn't stand that woman, I couldn't stand it. And it's as I've already said, it was ridiculous. You soon see that she's a really good teacher. She's got a great sense of humour, yes. She's got a great sense of fun and of the ridiculous, but she can teach. When there's a kid that's got behavioural problems, she can deal with it. First, she, you know, is quite jolly and can deal with her fascist driving instructor. When it comes to the crunch, she can deal with him, you know. She's grounded, she's intelligent, and she's sophisticated, you know. So people that have that reaction to the film, I think, as I've said, it tells us more about them than it does about the film, actually.
Triple R. And we now turn our attention to a film that feels quintessentially Mike Leigh. It's Another Year.
This is for you, Tom.
Ah, Buenos Aires.
Yeah, because I thought that, well, you went there, didn't you? The two of you, Argentina.
No, I didn't, no.
Didn't you?
Set over a year, as the name suggests, Another Year follows the lives of a very content couple, Tom and Jerry, played by Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen. As they approach retirement, they are visited by friends and family less happy with their lives. Telford, why is Another Year your favourite Mike Leigh film?
For me, this is the one for me. I've seen this movie more times than just about any film. I watch it constantly. With people who haven't seen it, I love to sit down and make them watch it. I think it's one of the most accurate depictions of relationships I've ever seen. And every time I watch it, I get different things from it. And I identify with different characters. And I see people that I know in the characters over and over again and in the dynamics and in the relationships in a way that is unusual. And I think that every kind of scene in it, there's some reality to like something I've been through or someone's been through. I don't know. There's something about it that I just never, ever get sick of. And I feel like I've seen it since it came out, so that's 15 years. And I feel like I said to someone the other day, sometimes in my life I'm the Mary and sometimes I'm the, you know, the Tom and Jerry. And I think it's a perfect film.
I love that as a definition of a favourite film, because there's lots of films, if I was to be like, oh, what are my top 10? There'd be so many on there that like, I will never see that film again. I've seen it. I don't need to go through that again. But I much prefer this kind of this return viewing and different interpretations, different things that come up. And that's a sign of a really rich and complex film landscape and performances. There's obviously a lot to dig into it there. Tyler, what did you think of Another Year?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I'm really interested to hear, Telfer, that this is one that you can come back to a lot. One of the things that I think, and it's debatable whether this is fair or not, that is often said about Mike Lee is that his movies are really depressing. Maybe that's true. Sometimes I agree with that. Sometimes I don't. I think they're also like side-splittingly hilarious.
Mm. Yeah, so funny.
But I would say Another Year is one that I struggle to revisit because I get just too sad. I get too sad. And similarly to you, Telford, I've been the Tom and Jerry. I've been the Leslie Manville character. And when the credits roll on a Mike Lee movie, I don't think... like, it's pretty rare that you get a sense of objective closure. More often than not, you get this very strong sense that, okay, credits rolled, an hour later in these people's lives, it's going to continue the same way that it has over the last 2 hours that I've just seen. And I think Another Year is, for me, the most emblematic example of that. And I, once the credits roll on Another Year, I get so depressed. Even though it is, yeah, a really, really beautiful movie. But I think Leslie Manville's performance is just so, so empathetic and so full of pathos, to the point where I would absolutely recommend anyone listening who hasn't seen it to go and watch it as soon as possible. But
seconded.
Yeah, you're on your own on that one. One funny thing is Tom and Jerry. Do you know that that's the name of the cat and the mouse?
Yeah, I do.
And it's only referenced once in passing in the whole movie, which is very smart.
Yeah, we don't want to hear it a million times. I feel like me blubbering through a film usually endears me immediately to it. Sarah, is this up there with one of your favourite leads?
Yeah, this would definitely be up. I mean, yeah, I'm not a huge ranker of texts or things that I love. But this is definitely up there. It is really wonderful. This maybe stands out the most as an example of something that a technique that Mike Lee has in quite a few of his films. It's not a gimmick he doesn't do in all of his films, but in a fair few, and I think it does happen to a certain extent in Happy Go Lucky, definitely happens in this one, happens in Topsy Turvy, and there might be a few others that you guys can think of, where at the end of the film there's suddenly a turn and you realise that you're offered a different way of understanding or sympathising with, or you know, or realising that you've been failing to pay attention to something at the end of the film, right? So, like in this film, you know, Tyler was talking about how empathetic Happy Go Lucky can be to Eddie Marson's driving instructor character, who otherwise is, you know, is racist and misogynist, is conspiracy theorist, just kind of generally deranged. But there is this moment where he says to Poppy, you know, like you have to make everyone love you. And there is, even though I think Poppy's still fundamentally a sympathetic character, you do think back on like quite a few scenes in the films where you're like, well, why when this driver driving instructor was so deranged from the outset, why did she keep going back to him when he was quite abusive to her from the beginning? In the opening scene of the film, she can't stop needling this bookshop employee who's having none of her to try and get a response, you know. Like there's other situations where, you know, the scene with the homeless man, which is kind of borderline, but like
the flamenco dance scene.
Yes, yeah, where she's like she
tests at those.
Yeah, kind of she's annoying, pushing. Yeah. Yeah, and you're like, well, why don't you have these boundaries? And you do realize that maybe, especially when there's a reference to the bad relationship with the father, that like her joy and her kind of like silliness and playfulness is also kind of like, it's a fawning, but it's also like an armor in a certain way. And I think that certainly happens in Another Year, where Leslie Manville's character begins, you know, for the sort of the first half of the film, she's a bit silly, she's drunk all the time. It's very funny the way she gets too drunk. you know, we're kind of positioned to not loathe her, but just like find her like laughable and silly and not take her very seriously. And then she starts kind of cracking on. She gets these romantic delusions where she thinks that her friend's son, who's like 25 years younger than her, 20 years younger than her, you know, they could like have a romance. She's cracking on to him. She's very rude to his girlfriend. And all that becomes more and more mortifying. And then suddenly there's the empathy given to her in the final section of the film is so generous that we really, her pain and how lost she is and how kind of just through some various turns in life, she's ended up in this really genuinely difficult position that she's unwell and she's not able to ask for help. And Tom and Jerry, who otherwise have been these very charming, delightful characters, you know, you also think, well, yeah, kind of they've just, everything's come easy to them and they haven't had to struggle. So they're lovely people, but they also haven't had to struggle that much. And you reassess how you understand the film without suddenly being like, oh, wait, this person's an angel, actually, and the other people are villains.
Yeah.
You have, it's like, as Tuff was saying, you can identify with different people throughout your life each time you watch it, but also you're able to, like, to understand the characters with greater complexity or the story in a new way, which I find very rich and moving.
Oh, absolutely.
Can I just read this quote out just because you've said that, Sarah? But I was just thinking, I read this thing today that Mike says, it's an unhealthy habit to say that life is what you make it. And if you want to be happy, then just be happy. It's just rubbish. Yeah, these people are, it's not their fault. And I think Vera, what's her name, Imelda Staunton at the start of this movie, which is an amazing, like,
Tuesday. Tiny performance.
Incredible.
Yeah.
But she says nothing changes. And I think about that a lot. And you're like, I think that's the thing about a lot of his movies, right? You're like, none of these characters' lives are changing.
Yeah.
That guy, Eddie Marzan's character, is not going to change. There's a couple of times where you think maybe he might change, or you think that Mary might change in this, or that Ken might change. Mm. And that beautiful moment that I think about a lot where Ken is sitting out the back with, and he's just started crying, and then him and Jim Broadbent have that beautiful scene where Jim Broadbent very gently says, let's go on a walking tour. We'll do the pubs. We'll take as long as you want. You know, we'll stay in nice places. What do you say? And he goes, R-r-r-r. And you just know that that trip is never happening. And that eventually that friendship, this guy's trying, but there's such a truth to that about certain friendships and just being like, either people are too much work or you just can't put in any more effort because these people are beyond help. Yeah.
Each of you have touched upon in different ways the space that Lee affords, like the conversations, the actors, the performances themselves, and even just visually the space, like that he's working with Dick Pope again on this one, and just the actual visual space allowing
that house
to
they have is just so gorgeous,
yeah. And just allowing for those things to exist, this duality, this lack of an ending in yet another year, and then another year will come again. I just feel like there's a beautiful openness and just acceptance, almost like a radical acceptance to these characters and the complexities of human relationships.
Blake, we wanted to hear how you cried in this one.
I cry in so many films. I do love this film, but Hard Truths for me is perfection.
Here we go.
Spoiler alert.
Here we go.
You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
You'll be 64 now.
64? Blimey, he's older than me.
Almost a pensioner.
You'll be past it now, Mary. Give us your hand.
Oh, no, Tom. He was lovely.
Well, we all grow old.
It's about sadness and it's about frustration and about disappointment and fulfilment and generosity. As always, I reached that point when I shared with Dick Pope. He was a great cinematographer, a great colleague, a great friend, and a great guy. When it came to another year, I was a little bit more vague than I sometimes. It's this and it's that. And he said, OK, I'll shoot some tests. And we went into a preview theatre at 8 o'clock in the morning in Soho in London. And he said, look, I've shot four different looks. See what you think. Choose which way you want to go. And I sat there and I suddenly thought, oh, I know what this is. We'll do spring, summer, autumn and winter. In fact, what he then developed was a different look for each of the four seasons, and he does that brilliantly. And, of course, that meant I then went back into my work with the actors, and that informed my sense of narrative structure, and that was very helpful. And so that's just an illustration of, the relationship between the cinematics and the dramatics.
Triple R. And it is now time for our third and final review of the night and Mike Lee's most recent film to date, although there is another one in the pipeline. It is Hard Truths.
Your sister called me.
Who?
Chantel.
I know who my sister is, thank you very much. When are you going to settle down?
Well, you have somebody for me.
Yes, Jesus.
In Hard Truths, Marianne Jean-Baptiste is Pansy, a depressed and anxious woman who routinely criticises her introverted son Moses, her meek husband Curtly, and basically anyone who stands in her way. The film was named one of the top 10 independent films of 2024 by the National Board of Review, and Jean-Baptiste won Best Actress at several awards shows, and for some of those ceremonies became the first woman of colour to do so. Sarah, Hard Truths.
Yeah, so this is probably my, it's nice that we are popping across everyone's favourites. I love this film. The first half is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. My partner and I were like crying, laughing in the cinema. You know, it turns, it's not as funny in the second half. But I just find the performances so incredible. If you've ever, it's objectively funny, but also I think if you've ever had in your family or worked with or been friends with, you know, everyone has encountered or been Pansy at some point in their life, has like that kind of just endless rage, which can be very funny, but can also be devastating. Yeah, I just find it a very adept representation of a family. It's very, this film in particular really speaks to the value of Lee's, the way that he devises the films, and this very collaborative aspect, because, this is like a really wonderful representation of like Black Caribbean British life and family that feels very lived in and authentic. And I think that comes from, Michelle Austin and Marion Jean-Baptiste and the other actors bringing their own experience and language and dynamics and behaviour to that. Yeah, I remember the first time I've seen it a few times now. And the first time I watched it, there's a moment towards the end where some flowers get thrown, which was what I felt so profoundly shocked by.
There's a real violence to it. It's funny because there's a lot that happens in the film and obviously a lot of explosive anger. And that was such a quiet scene in lots of respects, and I remember just doing this sharp intake of breath. I was shocked.
So shocking. And I also think the film is so interesting in terms of the title, right? Hard Truths, because sometimes I think in Lee's films there's like paying attention to the scenes that feel like a little like slightly different to the rest can be really illuminating. Like, I think there's this, in this film, like, we see Pansy, like, constantly raging against the world and all this foolishness that's so funny and then so, like, sad. But, like, there's this one lovely scene between her two nieces who are, like, lovely, joyful, bright young woman, both working professionally. And, we've seen them have this, like, really lovely relationship with their mother, with each other. And they both have these disappointing, kind of humiliating experiences at work. Not, like, crisis level where they would need to leave or anything, but just, like, the kind of day-to-day disappointments that you might encounter at work. And then they meet up with each other and, laughing and joking and drinking champagne. And one of them, asks how her day's been. And she lies to her and says it was fine and went well. And then they, like, just keep laughing and moving on. And it makes you think about, like, well, are those, like, small kind of, like, white lies? Like is that false? Is that a kind of grace or care that you're doing if you're just moving on and not dwelling on these things? Because also, like, when Pansy is raging against the world, the things she's not necessarily wrong all the time.
It's like preach.
Police are like a racist. Like, babies don't need pockets, But it's just that she funnels it into like crazy rage rather than.
I really loved that scene between the two sisters. And I love the camera movement here because it's not rushing to do a close-up or a medium shot. It's just allowing for these two women to sit there, to have this conversation that is untrue.
Yeah.
This kind of almost like toxic positivity to it. And that's such a beautiful contrast to this lively anger of Pansy. I mean, she's so captivating to watch on screen. Her diatribes are almost like a Tourette's-like sort of just there's so much of it. Then we see this sort of shift in her when she's almost just becomes childlike with how silent she becomes. Yeah. I just found that progression of her character so devastating, and the warmth of her sister.
Yeah.
And it's so much is being communicated just through the eyes. Oh, just this is such a perfect film to me. Yeah. Tyler, what did you
agreed
make of Hardroots?
No, this is a perfect film. I think rightfully so, a lot of emphasis when discussing Lee's put on the actors and his process with the actors and their performances. But sometimes I find that a little, maybe not disappointing, but I would like to hear more about his relationship and collaborations with heads of department, because of course, as we mentioned before, Dick Pope shoots this film beautifully. There is a real stark sharpness to the image that is breathtaking. Even when he's shooting a department store, it's still gorgeous, but never ever drawing attention to itself. But I guess in particular, the set design and production design in this film is really quite special. There's Lee will almost never use cinematic techniques in a way that is obviously decipherable, obviously ripe for analysis. Whereas in this film, there's just this extreme stark contrast. I mean, I guess a little bit like Another Year, actually, the different film stocks between the seasons. But between Pansy's home and the way that it's decorated, there's one photo frame in the entire house, and it's her and her husband's wedding photo. And aside from that, there's like not a single frame on the wall. When the flowers finally make it into the house later in the film, you kind of get the sense that that's the first pop of color that is that's like introduced itself into the house, and it's so unnatural.
Yeah, she has to put it in a water jug. They don't even have a bath.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, don't you feel like when the door is opened and the outside world comes in, you feel it. Sitting there.
Yeah. But I think Lee's films are deceptively cinematic, I would say. He's not rolling out, you know, 100 meters of dolly track for a dialogue scene. He's not getting out a crane or a jib, but there are extremely subtle, not only camera movements, but very, I think, unique cinematic choices in this film that really, really drew me in. And I guess all of that is to not even touch on the performances and the story, which I found profoundly emotional. I feel like a bit of a broken record when I talk about Lee, and it feels like the most superficial thing that you could possibly say to say, they're funny, but they're sad too. You know?
It's true, though.
Don't forget, they have both. And it's like, you kind of hear that, and I feel like a lot of people might think, yeah, well, so is everyone. Like, any good movie is able to harness those two qualities, like, in equal measure. But really, truly, if you haven't seen a Mike Lee movie, I don't, especially this one, I haven't had any of his films quite hit me with such a polarity of, like, as you mentioned, Sarah, the, like, side-splitting first half to the truly devastating second half. It was just so profound.
Also wonderful to finally see a filmmaker who gets better with age. That doesn't always happen. Telford.
I don't know. I think it's just when you first see Pansy and you're like, can they keep this up? Like, it's a bit like the opposite of the Poppy character, right? You're like, there's no way this is going to be the whole movie. Like, there's going to be a point where she's going to soften or she's going to change. And then you're like, no, she has a sort of brief sort of moment where she kind of gets sad, but you're like, just the energy of having to keep that up all the time. And like, we were talking about that house, and like, again, it's like the anti-house in Another Year, which is so charming and cozy and full of beautiful things. And this one is like a prison. And she keeps it a prison herself. Like, there's nothing allowed in that house. And you know that neither of those two could have. But I sort of get the feeling rewatching it that I often wonder what their relationship was like when they first met, her and what's his name?
Curtly.
Yeah. And whether they were always that unhappy, or if it's like, as they say in American Beauty, we used to be happy. Like, maybe one time they did have a good life and something's happened. And I read somewhere that this isn't addressed in the movie, but there is a lot of assumptions that she had some sort of COVID-related, something had kind of triggered in her during the COVID pandemic, and like either it was getting stuck inside or some kind of health issue that it maybe kind of has really sort of screwed her up.
I mean, I saw people saying that, but Mike Lee himself has been very resistant to that reading. He said, like, he could have made the film 30 years ago and it would be exactly the same. And I do think that, certainly her, like, obsessive control and, like, cleaning and everything is, to me, it's what the thing that is more likely to have triggered or worsened her is the death of her mother rather than COVID.
Yeah. And they do touch upon that in the film. Yeah. They do go into that space a little bit.
That's the thing, because that is the one decorative element really in the home, you know, that towards the end we do see that she has a photograph of her mother with two candles on either side. Yeah, she also, they talk, you know, when they're at the graveside, they talk about, like, that as a little girl she couldn't be happy and she didn't know why. Like, that clearly this has been, that maybe this is, it's now, we're now at a more exaggerated or, you know, worsened point. This unhappiness and anger has, you know, always been present or part of her.
Getting shivers talking about this again. Hard Truths is currently streaming and rentable on Prime Video. You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
And her over there with that fat baby. Cold, 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 and she's walking up and down the street with nothing but a big pink bow on its bald head so everybody can tell it's a girl, like I care. Parading it around in the little outfit, not dressed for the weather, nah, with pockets. What's a baby got pockets for? What's it going to keep in its pocket? A knife? It's ridiculous.
I hadn't worked with Marianne Jean-Baptiste for all those years, since Secrets and Lies. What I've been doing over the many, many years in films and plays is to look at different corners of society. So I thought, OK, now is the time to look at black family. I've had black characters in my films on and off quite a lot, but I thought now's the time to focus on that. But as to what the film actually is, which is a study of the kind of emotional problems that it is, and behavioural problems and relationships, that really wasn't quite there yet. That really evolved once we start exploring. I went on the journey of making the film. Susie Davis designed it again. Susie Davis, who is a brilliant designer, I mean, you know, she designed Barbie, for example, just to illustrate her versatility. It's a collaboration between the production designer, the costume designer, and indeed the makeup designer, and the actors and me. At first, of course, she started to put together, knowing that this was a family of a Jamaican background, various kinds of interesting, colourful Jamaican artefacts of various kinds that, as she assumed, such people would have around the house, as indeed the sister does. And Marianne said, no, not Pansy. Pansy wants nothing there. It's sterile. There's nothing on the walls. It's bland. And we found the house that would lend itself to that. I mean, it's a brilliant piece of sterile anti-design, you know.
You've been listening to Primal Screen on Triple R with Sarah Richardson, Telford Mills, Tyler Bain and myself, Flick Ford. On tonight's show, we revisited the work of writer and director Mike Lee. As always, you can listen back to tonight's episode on the Triple R website, rrr.org.au, or subscribe to the Primal Screen podcast. Sarah, Telford, Tyler, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Flick.
Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure.
I could have talked about Mike Lee for 5 more hours.
Yeah. There we go. Part 2 coming soon.
And I love Primal Screen. Everyone should listen to Primal Screen.
Thanks for listening to Primal Screen, a weekly radio show airing Monday evenings on Triple R. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast version and feel free to get in touch via the Primal Screen Facebook page or the Triple R website.